All right, our next case is Allen versus First Unum Life Insurance Company. All right, counsel, whenever you're ready, we may begin.
Good morning. May it please the court. This is a case about a burden of proof standard that the district court incorrectly applied on summary judgment and at trial. For 90 years, the Florida Supreme Court has correctly recognized that once an insurer has made payments to a disabled insured under a disability insurance policy, and the insurer wishes to extract itself from its payment obligations, the burden rests with the insurer to demonstrate that the condition of the insured no longer comes within the purview of the policy. These insurers paid Dr. Allen for 5 years through August 22nd of 2015. And Dr. Allen satisfied his burden of demonstrating that he suffered from a condition. That's the first requirement in the policy, that he has a sickness. And he demonstrated that he had floaters, visual disturbances across his visual field, and he also suffered from glare. In addition to that, he demonstrated that he couldn't perform the duties, the substantial material duties of his occupation of diagnostic radiologist, which the insurers agreed required very, very good vision. Lastly, he demonstrated that he was receiving the appropriate care from his physicians. Three of the policies say that he just has to have care and treatment, and the fourth is that he has appropriate care.
I thought there was evidence in this record by his own treating physician, Dr. Swartz, who testified that his complaints were, quote, out of proportion to his exam findings.
Well, in fact, Dr. Swartz, when he testified at trial, indicated that Dr. Allen continued to suffer. He was symptomatic the whole time, and he definitely has floaters.
But counsel, I guess I speak for myself only, is that here there was a jury trial, and you're correct that the standard articulated by the Florida Supreme Court and that we followed in Shapps is that Florida law places a burden of proof on the insurer, requiring her to establish by a preponderance of the evidence that the condition of the insured is such that he no longer comes within the purview of the policy.
Right.
And the verdict form that was presented to the jury after all the evidence was presented at trial was, have defendants proven by a preponderance of the evidence that Dr. Allen was no longer disabled under policy one as of August 22, 2015, and it went through all the four policies, and the answer was yes. So how are we supposed to reverse this case?
So a week before the trial began, there was a pretrial conference, and appellees offered to stipulate that Dr. Allen had met absolutely every condition in the policy, all of the requirements through August 22nd of 2015. That was then incorporated into the final jury instructions. And then from the opening statement all the way through summations, the district court made evidentiary errors that placed this litigation on a trajectory where the appellees were allowed to argue that Dr. Allen effectively was never disabled to begin with. They were allowed to offer evidence of 20 years worth of medical records that predated even his disability claim in 2010. Now, when we heard the standard and we understood the standard that the court was allowing, that the insurers had agreed, because they paid Dr. Allen, that he was totally disabled through August 22nd, 2015, to bring in.
Why isn't that relevant to show that the existence of floaters alone doesn't render him incapable of performing the duties of a radiologist?
Well, because of the stipulation and the way it was incorporated into the jury instructions, the judge charged the jury that Dr. Allen needed to prove nothing, and that absolutely everything under the policy was proven through August 22nd of 2015. So
But that's not true. That's not what the jury instructions say.
That's the jury verdict form, Your Honor.
I'm talking about the jury instructions. Okay. The jury instruction says element three requires defendants to prove that they did not breach their obligation. To do so, the defendants must prove by preponderance of the evidence that Dr. Allen no longer met the definition of total disability. And then it says, it talks about what total disability means. And there was a whole discussion in the jury instructions. So there was never any indication. The jury still had to make a finding that he was no longer disabled under the policies.
Right.
And as instructed in the jury instructions.
Right. And so our position has always been that once that burden shifted, it was now the onus on insurers to demonstrate that Dr. Allen no longer suffered from the condition that they conceded he suffered from for five years.
That's where I disagree with you. I think that what they had to show was that he was no longer disabled under the policy. And the reason is because the Florida statute or the Florida standard that you're citing is a procedural standard. It's not a substantive standard. But I hear you to be arguing that it's a substantive standard. And if that's what you're arguing, I need you to explain why, because I'm not getting that.
Yeah, so we're not arguing that it's substantive. And if we look to the language of Shapps, the Florida Supreme Court Shapps, there were three Shapps decisions. This was the second one in a series where this court asked the Florida Supreme Court to answer a certified question. The Florida Supreme Court said that this is procedural. The burden of proof is procedural because it addresses the means and methods to apply and enforce the duties and rights under a contract. And we think that flows directly to the concept of determining if someone continues to be suffering from the conditions, because these are the three requirements of the policies.
But the contract requires that he be disabled, meaning that he can't perform his then current employment, right? I mean, and so the reason why it is that he can't perform the employment is sort of incident to, but not the reason why he's you know what I'm saying? He's like, in order for the insurance companies to be able to meet and satisfy their burden, they need to show that he can now perform his prior job as a radiologist, right? I mean, they don't need to show that he no longer suffers from floaters. They just need to show that whatever the floaters are that he suffers from aren't so great at this point in time that they prevent him from being able to exercise his employment as a radiologist.
Right, that he's no longer.
Do you agree with that?
I agree. I agree that they have to demonstrate that he no longer suffers from the condition he suffers from that caused him to be unable to perform
substantial material duties
of his occupation of diagnostic radiologist, because I'm going directly to what the policies say, right?
Okay, so I think we're having a disconnect here.
Okay.
I think that the insurance company is required to show that even if he still has floaters, his floaters have improved to the extent where he can now perform his job as a radiologist. If they can show that, then they satisfy the Florida standard. I'm understanding you to say that the insurance companies instead have to show that he no longer has floaters. And I don't think that's right if that's what you're saying.
And the reason why we advanced that position is because we go back to Ewing, where the Florida standard is clear, and effectively the way the court looked at a person's status at the time they were being paid, it was an agreed upon status.
But the issue also is that this is a contract, okay? And so under the contract, and there's four different contracts, but contract policy 1, 2, and 3 are the same language, and policy 4 is a little different. But policies 1 through 3, it says in order to be what a total disability means, So what the insurance company has to show by preponderance of the evidence is total disability requires that Dr. Allen have a sickness within the meaning of the policy, and two, due to that sickness, not be able to perform the substantial and material duties of his occupation as a diagnostic radiologist, and three, be under the care and attendance of a physician. And so the way I read the record is your obligation was to show that floaters were a substantial and material detriment to him and didn't allow him to perform his job in order for him to be totally disabled. And the jury didn't believe that.
But no, that wasn't our burden. It was the insurer's burden.
I understand it's the insurance burden.
So that he was no longer.
But they were able to show that even with floaters, he could still do and perform a substantial material duties of his occupation. And that's why the jury found against your client.
And we believe that because of the evidentiary errors of opening the claim up from before the claim even started all the way beyond August 22nd, 2015 was error. And the district court shouldn't have allowed evidence in of a motive to make a claim when it was a settled fact that he was disabled through August 22nd of 2015. So we feel that those errors were highly prejudicial to Dr. Allen, including allowing a Rule 701 witness to testify as an expert. That was the last thing that the jury heard before summations. Dr. DiLoreto testifying as a 702 expert when he wasn't allowed to. The district judge said, you're only allowed to testify as a Rule 701 lay witness. And so that testimony came in, and that was significantly prejudicial to Dr. Allen.
All right. Thank you very much. And you've reserved 5 minutes.
Yes, I have. Thank you.
All right. Is it Marr?
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. John Marr representing the appellees. Your Honors were correct in the questioning as far as this is a contract case. It's very simple on the burden shift. The contract terms are read, and my clients had the burden of proving with the preponderance of the evidence that he does not meet that definition. I would note that in addition to the verdict form exactly saying that, that was exactly taken from plaintiff's proposed jury instructions, where the plaintiff says the defendant has the burden to establish by what the law calls a preponderance of the evidence that as of August 2015, plaintiff was no longer totally disabled as that term is used in the policies. And that's exactly what was used in the verdict form, and that was exactly what was found by the jury. These questions of total disability are questions of fact, and that is what the jury's found.
All right.
Where do we go in order to find the appropriate burden of proof in a disability case like this one?
You would go to, well, the most recent enunciation of that would be the Shapps case.
It wouldn't be Frechter versus Aetna Life?
Frechter was the original Florida Supreme case back from the 1930s, I believe. Mm-hmm. I actually tried the Shapps case. The 11th Circuit then certified the question as to whether the burden of proof was procedural or substantive mm-hmm. for purposes of a conflict of law analysis in Shapps. And the Florida Supreme Court said it was procedural. Not a presumption, not substantive, just procedural. And that's exactly the correct standard that was applied here by the court. And there was nothing erroneous.
There's a two-part standard.
I'm sorry.
It's a two-part standard. Is there a shifting of the burden?
No, Judge. It's like the insurer has the burden of proof.
Right.
And that's kind of it.
The insurer has to prove that he no longer meets the definition of totally disabled, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so then it becomes whether or not the severity of the condition has changed, right?
No, Judge, that's not even an issue. The mm-hmm. entire question, this is a breach of contract case. The entire question is whether Unum breached the contract by cutting him off, terminating his benefits in 2015.
Okay, so it's clear that the burden of proof at all times remains on the insurer.
Yes, Judge.
Okay.
I mean, it's a shifting burden, I suppose. If once we prove it, they can disprove it, but it's really one question. And that was the question that was asked to the jury. I would also point out that the initial cause of disability was not floaters and glare. It was an acute condition, which was called a posterior vitreous detachment, PVD, and a left retinal tear.
And I'm sorry to cut you off, sure. But the question I have for you goes to Dr. DiLoreto's testimony, and it does seem to me that more was admitted there than Federal Rule of Evidence 701 allows for. And I wanted you to address that.
Sure, Judge. Dr. DiLoretta was properly admitted as giving opinion testimony as a lay witness. And Judge Steele correctly found that you can give opinion testimony if it's based upon your known expertise and your observations. Dr. DiLoretta actually performed testing on Dr. Allen. And I would point to the court to the Sedent versus U.S. case, which I believe is now the controlling precedent on this question of expert witness testimony involved in this type of case. And it talks about whether the witness is retained or non-retained, right? If the person is going to have to do an expert witness report, then they are retained witnesses. And if they only have to do a disclosure, they are non-retained. And that court says an expert is retained, this is the opinion of your court, an expert is retained only if his connection to the litigation was from the beginning as a paid expert witness. That is not how Dr. DiLoretto came on the scene. Dr. DiLoretto was retained by Unum because in its search for some kind of finding supporting Dr. Allen's disability, Dr. Schwartz, the attending physician, had said, well, there's this one last test called a contrast sensitivity test that some research has shown that may be affected by floaters. And so Unum went and found Dr. DiLoretto, who performs contrast sensitivity testing on occasion, though rarely, because it's not something that really applies to this type of condition. It's more a cataract test. And so that is why he was retained. It was to perform the contrast sensitivity testing. All of his testimony, Judge, related to his observations and findings as a result of that testing. It was not hypotheses.
Well, that was actually what I was going to get to. You anticipated my question. I mean, some of it does seem like it might have been hypotheses, right? I mean, he basically said, that he was surprised that in June of 2010, Dr. Allen stopped working at the time, because at the time he had only floaters in one eye, and most people are able to function with floaters in one eye. It's kind of, I mean, that's kind of opining on something that is not really observing him, or, I mean, he didn't observe him in 2010.
Well, it was his mental impressions based upon his taking of the history from Dr. Allen. And so that is not the type of hypotheses that you're saying, like, assume, you know.
Not the typical expert hypothetical. Yeah, but it still kind of is. I mean, it's not really observational in that, as I said, he wasn't there 5 years earlier. So how could he opine on whether Dr. Allen's condition, on whether Dr. Allen's condition required him to stop working and disabled him? And also, especially given the fact that you all had stipulated that he was disabled at that time.
Well, he wasn't opining on that as much as giving his mental impressions and based upon his observation, Judge. So I don't think that's what they're talking about. And also, we have to remember that we stipulated.
Right, but why isn't that improper opinion, expert opinion testimony?
Because it was based
upon. It's not factual.
No, but lay people can give opinion testimony, as that's clear.
That's true, it has to be something within their area of knowledge, and it has to be something that would not otherwise and should not otherwise, you know, have scientific or expert knowledge involved.
Well, based on his experience, Judge, in dealing with other patients, in his experience, it was surprising to him that based upon only one eye, someone stopped working. That isn't, I don't believe that's the type of.
What is the relevance of that if you all stipulated that he was disabled at that time?
Well, there was no objection on relevance at trial on that testimony, no specific relevance on that. And also remember, Judge, that Unum did not have all the facts that during the time period it was paying Dr. Allen. It did not know that he had retired from his occupation a month before his first PDD, which was, of course, I know it's an overused term, but a smoking gun.
That's fine, but you all chose, I mean, you could have challenged that, but instead you stipulated and you chose that you were going to stipulate that he was disabled at that time.
Because,
so you're stuck with that.
Well, but Judge, there's different conditions, all right? As I said, the first condition for which his disability was accepted and put in an extended duration unit for 12 to 24 months, because there wasn't an anticipated change, was the PVD and the left retinal tear. And in 2011, he had a right side PVD because they often happen bilaterally, all right? So the question is recovery. The testimony at trial was that these conditions often improve over time. Those were his own doctor's statements.
Right, right. But again, how does that relate to whether or not he was disabled in 2010? And why is, right? I mean, you just told me that Dr. DiLoreto said, testified that he was surprised that in June 2010, he stopped working because he only, in other words, he's basically suggesting he didn't think he was disabled. And you were going to explain to me why it was that that wasn't really, I mean, in violation of the stipulation, I guess, and why it's relevant and why it's not expert testimony.
Well, I think that it's not expert testimony because he was not hypothesizing about facts unknown to him based upon his observation. He was giving his mental impression over the time that he was surprised.
Can I ask you a question? Let's assume that I think it was a hypothesis, but why would the error be harmless? Because I understand that I thought that Alan himself had included Dr. DiLoreto's report in his exhibit list.
Yes, Judge. First of all, they had Dr. DiLoreto's report, okay, which was very extensive. From before the time the litigation was filed, the claim file was produced to Dr. Alan at his request for his appeal. The plaintiffs pre-trial admitted not just the one exhibit that we referenced in our brief, Judge, that recites Dr. DiLoreto's report, but plaintiffs exhibit 69, exhibit 73, exhibit 74, exhibit 75, and exhibit 78 all include Dr. DiLoreto's report virtually in its entirety, including all of his conclusions about the contrast sensitivity testing, as well as no objective findings showing any problem with his visual acuity. And the other reason that it's harmless, if error, Judge, is that all the experts agreed that there were no objective tests to show Dr. Allen's disability, right? Because it was a subjective claim in its entirety, which depended entirely on credibility.
Right, which is why, I mean, look, it may well turn out that it was harmless for all the reasons you've just suggested, but it's also why if he was offering opinions as an expert in violation of the rule, that may have been a reason why that was prejudicial, right? I mean, the extra, anything extra that he was surprised business, whatever, that was not in the IME, you know, that may have been a reason why the jury would have been swayed because it was a credibility issue.
Well, Judge, I would point out too that when Judge Steele denied the motion in limine that plaintiff filed regarding the entirety of Dr. DiLoreto's deposition, he stated that they will testify as 702 witnesses and that objections would have to be made to specific questions at trial. There was no objection by plaintiff as to that particular that statement. And in fact, the first time it's come up is with Your Honor raising it. And that's fine, but they did not object specifically to that. So we could have cured that. And because I think that's a throwaway point as far as what his feeling is. I don't think
I just used that as an example of some of the testimony that Dr. Alan is challenging as having been admitted in violation of the rule. I'm not suggesting that specifically was the make or break. I'm just saying that is sort of illustrative of the arguable expert opinion testimony that they're claiming was admitted in violation of the rule.
Understood, Your Honor. Let me go back to CEDANT for a moment, because the question that there was comments about textualism earlier in an earlier argument. Judge Grant was looking at the text of, you know, Rule 26 and said the question was the expert retained to provide expert testimony or for some other purpose? And here, Dr. DiLoreto was retained for some other purpose. The case was not filed for another 3 years, I believe, after the 2015 exam. He was retained to perform that test that their attending physician had suggested might show some problem, because that's what Unum was looking for, was some kind of evidence that there might be some problem. And I'd also say that as far as the stipulation.
What would be your best evidence if Dr. De Loreto was excluded as a witness in the case?
I'm sorry, what would be?
If he was excluded as a witness.
We have all the really the same evidence, Judge. The only thing you lose is the contrast sensitivity test, because Dr. Schwartz said there were no findings and that the symptoms were in excess of the findings. Dr. Hoepner, Dr. Andrews, all of them had no explanation for how he can continue to be disabled from floaters that gradually improve over time. All right. And
that's why the admission of his testimony was harmless error.
And that's another reason, Judge. Okay. In addition to them just putting it into evidence pre-trial, mm-hmm. we certainly didn't object to it, but it's okay. All of it's in there. So if there are no further questions, Your Honors, I appreciate it. We would like to have the judgment affirmed in its entirety. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. All right. And you've reserved 5 minutes.
So addressing the issue of Dr. De Loreto, we did not read the Cedent versus U.S. case, this court's case that came out after the district court rendered its decisions on whether Dr. De Loreto was a Rule 701 or 702 witness. We did not see that as overruling the well-settled law of this circuit that if an opinion witness crosses the line and starts testifying about specialized knowledge, they become a 702 witness. And for that, there needed to be disclosures of an expert report and an opportunity for the opposing party to potentially move.
Yeah, you might be correct about that, but what do you have to say about whether or not the admission of his testimony was harmless error, given all of the other medical testimony in the case and the fact that this case pretty much rises and falls on the credibility of Dr. Allen?
So we disagree that the record actually displays that Dr. Schwartz, the treating physician that was at trial, indicated that the floaters weren't there or they were out of proportion, because he actually testified, and it's part of our record, that the floaters have continued to be there through, and the trial was in 2022. He was talking real time, because this was a treating physician that continued to treat Dr. Allen. So he continued to suffer from the floaters. He was highly symptomatic, and that nothing had changed in terms of him improving or getting better. Now, when it comes to the issue of whether the appellees have proven by a preponderance of the evidence that Dr. Allen could now perform his occupation, the record is devoid of any evidence from appellees demonstrating that he can perform his duties. Usually we'll see a vocational analyst from the insurers analyzing the occupation, looking at the medical condition. Even if appellees argue that, oh, it got better, they would look at that and they would say, oh, we think you can perform the duties of a diagnostic radiologist. There's nothing in the record to support that. Absolutely nothing. I'd like to just go back to Dr. De Loreto one more time if I could, because it was very clear from his testimony, and he was deposed as a fact witness. We deposed him as a fact witness. And then appellees toward the end of the deposition elected to do a trial style rendition of an expert direct examination. But he was asked not to treat Dr. Allen. So he was not a treating physician. He was engaged to examine and make an opinion. He was paid $4,000. He examined him one time. He testified that the only reason he did this was because IMEs pay good money. He was not a percipient or hybrid witness, because he was there to form an opinion that within 1 week of his opinion, Dr. Allen's benefits were terminated. So in addition to all of that he testified to, when appellees got a chance to take his, I guess, direct expert deposition, although he was called as a fact witness for the deposition, they laid a deep foundation of his expertise, his qualifications, the articles he authored. None of this was asked of him as a fact witness. This was appellees doing this because he was their expert witness. So to say that he validly testified and provided testimony to this jury as a lay opinion witness, we think that the record does not support that at all. Next, when it comes to the issue of the floaters and glare and the symptoms, when appellees had Dr. Allen examined and he rendered his report a week before benefits were terminated, He said, after he dilated Dr. Allen's eyes, "I see floaters everywhere." That's not a quote. He saw floaters. He took photos of them. That's part of the record. And then he said, "I would expect this patient to perceive these on a constant basis." So he basically certified that this condition had not changed. And this is Appellee's witness, expert witness.
Well, it kind of did change though, right? I mean, at the point when he was found to be disabled, he had retinal tears in both of his eyes, right? And he had surgery on that. Am I misunderstanding the record?
Yeah. So that's not 100% accurate. So he had a posterior vitreous detachment, which is a pulling away of the vitreous material away from the back of the eye. That causes floaters. He had that at the time he became disabled. Then a year later, he had that same thing happen in his right eye. On the left eye, when it first pulled away, within a week, he had a tear in his retina that was repaired. Now, Dr. DiLoreto, in his report, indicated that some people will continue to experience floaters. So they don't. For some people, they do not go away. And he indicated in his report, again, he examined Dr. Allen a week before termination of benefits, that Dr. Allen had 20/40 vision in one eye and 20/30 vision in the other. Well, from the beginning of the claim, while the insurers were paying Dr. Allen, he had 20/20 vision. So there was definitive proof that Dr. Allen's condition had actually worsened, and he affirmed that. And then upon that, his benefits were terminated.
All right. Thank you so much,
Thank you very much.
We'll be in recess until tomorrow.